Welcome to the Maroochydore Cosmos Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Peter and I am an alcoholic. The Cosmos Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous founded on the principle of one alcoholic sharing with another. We ask that if you have a mobile phone, please either turn it off or onto silent during the meeting. And whilst we're doing that, could we please have a moment's silence for all those suffering alcoholics yet to find the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Is there anyone that is new or returning to the program in the first 30 days of sobriety? Please stand and identify your number of days sober.
Stuart, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stuart.
Stuart?
26.
Good on you, Stuart. Well done. Welcome guys, you're in the right place. Are there any alcoholics present celebrating an AA birthday of more than 365 days of continuous sobriety? Any birthday? Yes? Stand up.
23 years.
Hey, Richard. Well done. Are there any alcoholics visiting from out of town?
I'm Mary, an alcoholic from Los Angeles, California.
Hey, Mary.
I'm an alcoholic from Los Angeles, California.
Thank you.
John, alcoholic, visiting from Brisbane.
Good on you, John. Welcome, guys. I will now ask Stephen if he will come forward and read a portion of Chapter 5, How It Works, from the basic textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Alcoholic, my name is Stephen.
Stephen.
Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are ready to go to, or willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. There you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which were suggested as the program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought, through prayer and meditation, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Don't be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if He were sought.
Thank you. Okay, so guys, this is probably not your normal night, as tonight is Founders Day, June 10th, and just a quote from the grapevine that somebody passed to me. This was written by Bill, June 10th. After telling Dr. Bob my story, I explained how truly I needed him. Would he allow me to help him? I might remain sober myself. The seed that was to flower as AA began to grow toward that light. And that was written by Bill in January of 1951. So tonight I'm going to probably not call as many speakers as we normally would, but I'm going to get through a few, and I'm going to ask one of our visitors if he would kick us off. John, if you would please start.
Yeah, good evening. My name is John. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
Hi, John.
I'm glad to be here and glad to be sober. I was thinking when I walked in the door, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was just turned 18, and I had no intention of being sober or getting sober. The only thing I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd seen Tom Hanks act in a little sitcom called Family Ties, and where he was a drunken brother who got sober. And I was living in Central Station in Sydney, and I was walking along a street in Surry Hills, and I walked past this building, and I sort of looked inside to see what was there, and there was a group of guys, and they were laughing, and they were serving hot food. And I walked in and said, "Oh, how do I get a free meal?" And they said, "Oh, we're a rehabilitation program for alcoholics." I said, "Oh, can I, what does that entail?" And they explained it to me. And I said, "Well, I'd like to come and stay here because I don't have anywhere to stay." And they said, "Well, you have to be an alcoholic." I said, "Oh, I'm not one of those." And the person took me into the registration, and he looked at me, and he was a nice guy, and he said, "Do you drink?" I said, "Oh, of course I drink." He said, "And what's a drinking session for you?" And I said, "Bottle of rum and a six-pack of beer and some Mylanta for the heartburn I'm going to get the next day." And he said, "And what happens when you drink?" I said, "Who knows? That's the best part about drinking. It's like a dream in reality. You stick it in yourself, and magic seems to happen. Like, all this stuff happens. It's great. I don't know." He said, "So you black out?" I said, "Every time. Best thing about drinking." He said, "But you're not alcoholic." I said, "No." He said, "Well, just sign this form to say you are an alcoholic and we'll let you come in." And I looked at it, and I was really, truly, really struggling to sign it. And he said, Why can't you just sign your name and just lie and say you're an alcoholic and come inside?" I said, "Because this might go on my record." And he's like, "Well, you know, it won't. It's not public information. It's just for us." I went, "No." I said, "People might find out about this." And he goes, "And what happens if they did? How bad would it be?" I said, "Well, I could end up the Prime Minister of Australia. And I wouldn't want people to know I was an alcoholic." And anyway, I signed it, and what I thought was a lie, and I went into this rehab, and thank goodness it was, you know, I got sober on the 23rd of April 1991, and they were still taking people to meetings. You know, and the first meeting I went to was Woolloomooloo in Sydney in the white bus. And, you know, I walked in, and there was probably 150 people there, and there was, you know, food down the side. And in those days, you were allowed to smoke in the meeting, and people were handing out cigarettes, and they were well-dressed or friendly. And, you know, it was just I thought, wow, I didn't know this was Alcoholics Anonymous. And then a couple of nights later, they took us to they took us to another meeting at Waverley on a Sunday afternoon, as Bill sees a meeting. And I got kicked out of that rehab, and then I ended up in another rehab, and they took us to meetings, and I got kicked out of that rehab, and then I went to halfway, and I got kicked out of that halfway. But the thing I never got kicked out of was Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they'd introduced me to AA. Although I'm pretty sure at one stage there was a vote at a group conscience that I wasn't allowed to go to that particular meeting, but I was never kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I just kept going to AA, and I really didn't know what was going on, and I didn't understand what an alcoholic was. I had the vision of the trench coat and the methylated spirits every day, and you had to lose a house and a job and a car and children, and I'd never even had any of those things to lose. And I just kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was glad I was surrounded by people that said, you know, just keep coming back until you sort of come to understand what's going on. And where I sort of paused for thought was when I walked in, I sat down. I remember when I was new, and even not so new, after I'd been here a long time, I was always slightly uncomfortable at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know why, if I went to a meeting I'd never been to, whether it's, you know, I'm not, you know, just slightly uncomfortable, or I get a little bit of anxiety. And funny enough, that never happens to me at Alcoholics Anonymous. This isn't my meeting, this is your meeting, but it is actually my meeting. I walk in here, I'm at home, I've got a right to be here because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I feel comfortable, I can sit down. And that happens for me wherever I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the few places in my life where I go where I have that instant comfortability. And you know, I get to travel a lot with my life and the work that I have. And I've been to some interesting meeting places where, you know, we were talking about it at dinner tonight. I went to a meeting only in the last 12 months in a city called Tianjin in Shanghai. And there was probably four people there, myself and three others. One was a local Chinese who'd spent time in America and got sober. Another one was a Canadian expat who was working there. So, you know, we're just doing a meeting with sort of three people to start with. And the meeting was going about 40 minutes. And this woman walked in, and she was visibly a local, you know, and she had the bamboo hat on, the worker's outfit, the white shoes, you know, that she'd been working in a factory or a field that's sort of evident there. And she didn't speak a word of English, and she sat down, and was about 10 minutes to go, and this person interpreted it for her. And basically what she said was, I came here 2 weeks ago. I have a problem with alcohol. Since I came here 2 weeks ago, I haven't had a drink. I've had a terrible day. I've had a terrible week. I'm finding it really hard, but I knew if I got to this meeting, I would feel better. And she traveled 4 hours by train to get to that meeting, you know. And I thought that was the very thing that happened to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, is I didn't know what was happening here. And we could sit here and talk about the community of the spirit, the identification that I heard when people talked about their drinking, and all of a sudden I wasn't different anymore, and I didn't feel isolated. I felt a part of. I recognized I had a problem in that first step, the solution. All of that stuff could be talked about forever. But the very basic thing was happening for me on a level that I didn't understand, and it wasn't here, it was here. That language of the heart they talk about was all of a sudden, I was home. And I don't know how that happened, but it just did, and it was on a much deeper level than what I understood. And it took a lot of time, and I was given some hope, and I kept coming back to meetings, and little by little, that hope changed, and it deepened to a faith, to a belief, to now an experience. You know, I know that if I go to meetings and I keep in contact with a sponsor and I do the best that I can to practice some of those basic maintenance steps on a regular basis, my life is 100-fold better than what it ever possibly could be if I wasn't at Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new, and there is some new people here, which is always exciting, I hope that's the message that you hear tonight, is keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous until you work out what's going on. You know, there is a solution here. There's a very good chance that you're not going to know what that solution is today, but if you keep coming back, you will be able to avail yourself to it. Thanks.
Good on you. Thank you. Charlene, please.
Hi, I'm Charlene. I'm an alcoholic.
Charlene.
I've been to a few meetings this week, and a lot of them have been ID meetings, just sick of the sound of my own voice. But anyway, I didn't start drinking at a really young age, but I I lived in London for a few years and in an industry, worked in an industry where everybody drank, in investment banking, and you know, took clients out, and it was encouraged and accepted, and my drinking started to take off there. But I didn't, you know, I was always able to keep down a job and go to the gym and travel and all those sort of things. So for a long time, I didn't look at my drinking as a problem. And when I came back to Australia, I met someone and had a few kids in quite quick succession. And during that time, I didn't drink either. And it wasn't until after I had my twins, who were 8 in August, that I started to drink differently. And by this stage, I was in an abusive relationship, had 4 little kids under 4, which I pretty much had to manage on my own. And yeah, my drinking changed. It was no longer drinking to go out and socialise and have fun. I was now drinking to get drunk, basically, and escape and block out my reality. And I just had the attitude, if you had my life, you'd drink too. And you know, I was hiding my alcohol and lying about how much I was drinking, and all the while kidding myself that I was doing a great job as a mum, because I would always feed the kids and bath them and get them off to bed before I started drinking. So, you know, I always told myself that was okay, but the reality was that if there'd been like a fire, or if one of my kids had been having a bad dream, I wouldn't have been awake, you know, to do anything about it. And fast forward a few years and I got rid of what I thought was the problem. And in that year, the next year, I drank more than I ever drank, because there was no one there to sort of try and control my drinking at all. And I reached a point where I had docs in my life and family court, and you know, I had so much fear, and I'd go to the bus stop to get the kids off the bus, and I'd almost make myself sick thinking I'm going to get there and the kids are going to be pacing. And you know, it's not a very nice way to live, and having the curtains closed and not answering the phone and not getting up to knocks on the doors and things like that. And I felt really, really isolated and ashamed and alone. And I knew as well, if I kept drinking, there would come a point where I could lose my kids, and I couldn't stop drinking. And the inevitable happened, and that was in the middle of 2013. And I rang my mum, this is in New South Wales, I rang my mum, who lives on the Sunshine Coast, and I told her what happened, and she said, "Miss Darlene, you'll have to come and live up here," because I wasn't able to afford to keep the home that I had. And yeah, so basically almost 3 years ago, I reached a point where I thought I'd lost everything everything that meant anything to me. And I came up to the Sunshine Coast. During this time when I'd been having my kids, I had popped in and out of AA. I wouldn't have called myself a member. I generally went along to AA when she hit the fan, and I'd go there, and I'd sort of go with the attitude of gauging how long I would have to stay before I could have that next drink, depending on how much trouble I was in. So, you know, sometimes I could stay dry for 6 months, 9 months, 2 months, but I could never stay. I could stop the drinking, but I could never stay stopped. And I just didn't think AA was for me. But, you know, I know now that I just wasn't ready. And came to the Sunshine Coast, and I didn't drink for 6 weeks, but I didn't go to AA. And I had a drink, and I ended up in Nambour Hospital in the cardiac ward, and nearly died. So I thought I had already lost everything that was worth anything, but I'd nearly lost my life as well. And I guess that's what it took for me to want to change and want to do something. And my nan, who's 92 now, came up to the hospital to pick me up, and she just looked so sad, and she looked at me and she said, "Darlene, do you think you should try AA?" And I said, "Yes, nan, I think I will." And that's when I came into AA on the Sunshine Coast, and thank God I was ready to be sober for myself. And I started to hear the message, and I started to hear suggested things like get a sponsor, do the steps, get a home group, do service, and get to lots of meetings. And that's what I did, and that's what I 100% threw myself into for the first year. And over time, when I started working through the steps with the sponsor and was able to have the faith that you had talked about earlier, that I was going to be okay, basically, that no matter what happened, that I would be okay. And that somehow, with that came acceptance of my situation. And then with that, I just lost the desire that I had to drink, and I no longer struggled. The first couple of months I was in AA, I had to really do a lot to keep myself safe and not drink, and then thereafter a couple of months that wasn't the case. And I got involved in service early, and became the secretary of a group, which is a really good way to chat and meet people and everything, and open up the meeting and people come in and they start helping you and you start talking. And anyway, in the last 2 and 3/4 years, I've been through a big family court case, and a whole lot of stuff that I would have used as an excuse to drink 1,000 times over in the past, and I've been able to get through all that without having to or needing to drink. And everything that I had lost has come back to me, and it's 100 times better. My kids are now back with me full time. I've got a beautiful home to live in, and I have the full support of my parents. Relationships have been restored. I've got a lot of work to do with my kids because they've been through a lot with domestic violence and having an alcoholic as a mother, but as a sober mum, I put one foot in front of the other, and I'm able to deal with that and be proactive in getting them the help that they need. And today I went and did Time for Change, which is another service that AA is a part of. People that have got in trouble with things at court, we go along and just share our experience, and maybe someone might hear it and think AA is for them. So my life I've still got a lot of work to do, and I've still got the struggles that that a lot of mums have in this situation. But I'm sober, and I want to be sober, and I want to stay sober. And AA has given me the life beyond my wildest dreams, and it's nothing fancy or extravagant, but just being sober and being able to feel everything and live a sober life is a gift, and it's a gift that I want to keep giving, especially to my kids. Thanks.
With that birthday boy.
I'm Richard. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Richard.
Glad to be at this meeting. I remember I came to this meeting about 20-something years ago and couldn't find it, and I had to go through the paddock to get here. But I got here. I saw a little glimpse of this thing and the thing. And it was nice of you, Clancy, to turn up again. I don't know whether you remember where you were 23 years ago, but I was in my first week of sobriety, and you were in a little church hall in Ann Street in Brisbane. And I was sitting in the second front row, because my group at that time, we all got there early and took up the front three rows, I think it was, so we could listen to Clancy. That was a good introduction to me. Anyway, I drank for the first time I ever had a drink. I just felt fantastic. It was just wonderful. I felt nervous and felt I shouldn't be there, and didn't feel old enough or big enough or smart enough, and I just had a drink, and it just was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And I just continued drinking for 30 years, but it didn't stay the same. What happens was, the next 10 years was pretty good. Actually, the next 15 was pretty good off and on. But I recognised that when I started having a few drinks, quite often I didn't want to stop, and other people did. That became, I really was very aware of that. And as I proceeded through my life, I just discovered if I drank during the week, I would have failed my degree, so I managed to be able to not do that. And then I graduated, and that's when things got worse again, because, you know, I didn't have to study yet. I could do it anyway. I moved in with a girl, and we used to have cocktails before dinner, and we hardly ever had dinner. And, you know, I didn't understand what I was doing. What I was doing was trying to manage my alcoholism. And I was sort of, I didn't have any choice. I didn't know there was another way of doing it. So I did it, and eventually, towards the end of the thing, the only safe place, and I got into all sorts of trouble and got out of it most of the time. And right at the end of my drinking, I was a prisoner on my own back deck, and I used to try and not have my first drink till after dinner. By this stage, I'd collected 3 kids and a wife and a car and a job and all the things they talk about in here. But I wasn't happy, and I was very tense, and I didn't want to exist like that. I really wanted to go out and have a drink, you know, and have fun and do all the things that I did when I first started drinking. And then one fateful day, this friend of mine rang up and said, "I'm in terrible trouble, can you help me?" And I answered the call. Unfortunately, she was in a pub on a Monday night, and I went there. And anyway, so I woke up on Friday morning, and I'd never actually done that during the week. You know, I had a fairly responsible job, and 5 people were waiting for me to tell them what to do, etc., etc. And I wouldn't normally do it. And I just went on this bender. Absolutely couldn't. Now, from time to time leading up there, I'd get off the back veranda and think, oh, I'll just go out to this party. Maybe this time it'll be different. And it never was. You know, in the beginning, sometimes I'd get away with it, but you know. But I'd go out and have a drink somewhere, and things, bad things would always happen. Or, you know, you have kids and the wife has to go and take over from the babysitter, so they leave you at the party. And, you know, and you won't leave until you've drunk everything in their house. And, of course, you never get invited back again. So people didn't invite me out anyway. But anyway, so I woke up this morning and I just couldn't do it anymore. I just looked, and I rang the office up for the first time in my life. I told them the truth. I rang up and I said, "I've been on a bender. I'll be in on Monday if I've still got a job." And I'd never told them that before, ever. They were shocked. And I put the phone down and I turned up. But before that happened, the woman who'd gone to AA, who I knew, she'd been to a meet. She'd stopped drinking for 3 months, and I couldn't believe that she'd done that, because, you know, 20-something years I'd known her, she'd always been a bit pissed, you know, she was one of those people. I just used to get outrageously pissed and fall over and go to sleep, but, if, you know, she was pissed all the time. And they were quite good friends, our kids knew each other and things, you know. Well, my son said to me one day, "Why does this drink bottle smell awful, Daddy, that I take to school?" Anyway, I picked it up and smelled it, wine, and I said, "That's not your bottle." And I said, "Where did you get this bottle from?" And, you know, "Oh, I got it from one of the other kids." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's hers. That's, you know, she keeps the wine in there." But anyway, I went. she'd been to AA, and I didn't know really. I'd heard about it, and I went and visited, and I didn't like the look of what was going on. To be quite honest, I went on a Tuesday to where the Brisbane office was, and it was rubbish bin day. And they had about, you know, 25 stinking bins at the bottom of this thing, and the lift didn't work, and you had to walk up 7 floors anyway. So I thought, "Oh, this is AA, I'm not really that interested in it." So I didn't go back. Anyway, we went to this meeting, and, you know, all these things happened to me, you know. The woman who told me came down to get me, because I drove into the meeting thinking, I don't know whether I want to come here, put my car in reverse, and down the stairs comes that woman, and the woman who was chairing the meeting, because they'd spoken to each other, and she said, "I think I know this bloke." So she comes down and says, "I wondered how long it was going to be before you got here, and whether you would at all." And she was my old barmaid. She's the one that I'd have shouts with my fellow students, and they wouldn't drink properly. And I was sitting at the end of the bar with a big pile of money, and she knew what to do. You know, I'd finish my drink, she'd just fill it up. And it worked perfectly. Anyway, I sat down at this meeting and I listened to people share, and then I really paid attention to 2 blokes who told my story. As I walked into this meeting too, they had this silly sign that said, "You can leave these rooms and never have the need to drink again." And I read that and I went, "These people don't understand what it's like." Anyway, I sat down and listened to these two blokes, and then at the end of the meeting I went and spoke to them, and they said, are you an alcoholic? I said, my doctor said I'm not, who I used to drink with. And I went through a whole series of things with this man, and we had liver function tests, and I went to ask him what the results were, and all he said was, yours were better than mine. He died 5 years later, but which is a long time ago. And he died, so you know, if he admitted I was an alcoholic, you know, he was in a lot of trouble. But anyway, so this woman came down and sort of told me about the meeting, and I went there and spoke to these blokes and gave me the book. And I read that book, took it home. I'd been, you know, that was Friday, and this was a Sunday meeting, so I took it home and read it. They just gave it to me. I didn't have to pay for it, I didn't have to do anything. And I took it home and I read it, and I went through all that doctor's opinion stuff, and I knew that there was something going on there. And I read that and I thought, that's me. That's me. These people know. And the other interesting thing was, when even in this room full of people, I liked it. And I liked the way they shared, and I liked their madness. You know, I really related to it. And I thought, oh, these people. And then you join the chain and they hold hands, and I could feel something going through my hands. I'm telling you, I could. Something was happening, and I thought, these people know something. They know something, and they're happy, and they've got terrible stories, and they're very like, and those two blokes was the same as I. Maybe this could happen to me. And I walked underneath that sign, and I thought, maybe this would happen to me. Anyway, I'd read the book through to quite a long way, and didn't understand much of it, but enough to know that I recognised all these things. And I rang him up and I said, what do I do? And he said, join a group, get a sponsor, do the steps and you'll get well. Because that's what I asked him, how do I get like you? And I just proceeded to do that. I kicked and screamed and complained and whinged and argued. And I'll never forget, I was looking at something I didn't want to do. So the step forward's a bit of a problem. And then I looked at some people who came in at the same time I did, and they'd done it, and they looked to me better than I did. They probably weren't, but they looked better. And I thought, oh, bugger, I'll give up, I'll just bloody well do it. And I've got a special soft spot for up the beach here, because I actually came up here when the kids were off at somewhere or other, and I did my fourth step, not the right way, by the way, but I did it anyway, up here at the beach. So I've got a soft spot for the beach. And you don't have to do 52 pages of your life story, which is what I did, because my sponsor's sponsor then went through it with a big red pen and said, these are the things you need to concentrate on. We don't worry about the rest. Thank you.
All right. I am going to pass the basket. We are fully self-supporting through our own contribution. And whilst the basket is being passed, Wayne is going to come up and read a portion of Chapter 3 more about alcoholism.
Hi, Wayne, alcoholic.
Hey, Wayne.
Chapter 3, more about alcoholism, page 30 of the big book, Basic Fact of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. No one likes to think he is bodily or mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers are characterised by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learn that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed.
Very good. Could I ask Mary to share, please? Okay.
Thank you. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
I was talking to Lana about high school before the meeting, and I was thinking about, because that's when I had my first drink, when I was a senior in high school. Because my mother had said to me, if you're a woman and you drink, you will ruin your family. And My mother and my mother was one of 15 kids, and my mother and her sisters, they did not drink, but they always had rosary beads praying for the people who did drink, and I knew that it was, I knew from my father's side of the family that it was horrible, and I had a cousin, Rita. She was my closest cousin in the world, and when we were sophomores in high school, she got married, she had three children, and one night, one of the kids was with her mother, but the other two kids were at home, and she got drunk, and she was smoking, and the apartment caught on fire, and both of the babies were burned to death, and I remember the funeral, and it was the last time I ever saw her, and she was just like banished from the family, because if you were Irish Catholic, you didn't talk, I mean, just, you were gone. So anyway, I didn't drink until, and then I was a senior in high school, and the nuns didn't like my dress. They said it was too low, and so I was embarrassed. They sewed netting on me. I looked like some crazy freak at my prom, and one of the boys said, come on out to the back of the gym, and I had a bourbon and Coke, which was my very first drink ever, and I distinctly remember doing cartwheels in front of the nuns after like my third bourbon and Coke. And I thought, well, this, why did my mother say this was so bad, you know? And so I, you know, that was the start, and it just never stopped. That was the thing. It just, there was no way for me once I started drinking ever to control it. But what I really thought about with my drinking tonight was how AA is everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere. It's free, and it's everywhere. I was once in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh, and I took a rickshaw to a meeting, and there were three people there, and I thought, oh, thank God, because when I was new, I felt so safe. I felt like I was finally in a place where I could really be myself, where I could really let down my defenses. Because when I came in here, I had so many defenses. And my defenses were the kind of thing, it was all about achievement. When I came in here, I had a great job, I had a house, I had a car. But inside, I was just a mess. I remember sitting on my sofa at night all the time, just drinking wine and calling boys on the phone. You know, do you love me? Do you love me? Meanwhile, of course, I was married, but I mean, that was like beside the point. But the other thing I thought about, I'm just going to say this for a minute, about my brother died about 10 days ago. And I thought about what AA has done for me. When I came in here, I hated my brother because he left when I was two. I mean, what did I know? He left to be a priest when I was two. So I just hated him. And I wrote my inventory. It was the most painful part of my inventory. The most painful part was my brother. And I probably would have never talked to him. But AA made me. I had to make an amend to this man. And I had to reach out to him, even though he never ever reached out to me. Over the years, I went to see him. I know all his family. I know his kids. I know his grandchildren. I've been to see him. I reached out to him. So I'm going to be 39 years sober July the 4th. Over the years, I did all this. And when my brother died, I was clean with him. My side of the street was clean. I knew I loved him, whether only twice in my whole life did he ever say he loved me. One time, which a week before he died, where I was in the hospital, he couldn't even speak, and I said, I love you. And he just raised his eyebrow and he squeezed my hand, and I thought, yeah. I thought, AA, without AA, I would have never spoken to this man. With AA, I have nieces, I have nephews, I have all these people. But then I went to the funeral and I looked in that casket. And I just want to say this to anybody who's made amends, who's done everything. I promise you, I looked in that casket And I cried like, maybe I've never cried in my whole sobriety over this man. And I thought to myself, without AA, I would not have reunited with my family. I would not have done all these things. And I thought to myself, what a great life this is. What I always say to new people, it's the best life you will ever have. You have no idea what a great life it is. And I think that now, I think that about my own children. I think that about, I knew my mother until she was 94. I had a great relationship with her. And I would have had none of this because really, the thing that I thought cured all ills was just to sit at the bar and take a drink and forget all the hurt that had ever been done to me. And it turns out, by the way, that I was the one who'd done most of the hurt, but I just didn't know it, so thanks a lot.
Clancy.
Sorry, getting my instructions. My name is Clancy Immerslund, and I'm an alcoholic. How are you? I'm glad that something I said 25 years ago helped you. You sound like a pretty tough case when you're talking. But I'm gonna deviate a little bit. Tomorrow I'm gonna talk here somewhere, and I'll tell my story at length until you all go to doze off. But tonight I'm gonna talk to you, the two new guys here, about something you probably don't know about. Many years ago, there was a guy named Bill Wilson. And he had drunk himself out of Wall Street and was living off his wife. And he had a terrible drinking problem. And he wound up in the hospital again, this hospital. And somebody had told him, you have to have some sort of an awakening. And yeah, that's right. But he woke up in the middle of the night and his heart was beating. And all of a sudden the lights came on. My God. There's nobody there to turn the switch on, and the windows were locked, and the wind was blowing through. He said, I'm going crazy is my problem. But he felt pretty good, and he went back to sleep. In the morning, he talked to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, I don't know what happened to you, Bill, but whatever it was, hang on to it. You had some sort of experience. Nobody knew what was wrong with him. But anyway, what he did, he went to some kind of a semi-religious group called the Oxford Group. He felt he had been given some sort of a divine assignment to help drunks. So he went to the Oxford Group every day for 6 months. And the Oxford Group consisted of kind of better type people meeting in one another's homes and very nice folks, and they get together and discuss spiritual values. And he'd bring in these street drunks. I believe you're vomiting on my shoes, sir. And nobody ever stayed sober. He tried to help him, and brought him home to his house sometimes. One of them committed suicide in his living room. Shocked his wife terribly. At the end of 6 months, he got up one morning. He noticed his wife was putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve. She'd been a very chic society lady when he married her. She was now kind of getting pudgy. And gray, black, and white hair, and obviously older. He said, Lois, I'm sorry. He said, I thought I had some sort of a assignment from God to help drugs, but apparently I don't. Not one person stayed sober. I tried to help them, and I'm going to quit today. I'm going to quit all that baloney. I'm going to get a job if it's just shoveling dirt, and I'm going to get you out of that damn department store where you're working. I'm going to give you some peace. He said, but I really thought I had something going for me, but it turns out nobody stays sober. And right then, our lives hung by a thread about that big. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her about 40 years ago up in Connecticut. I said, Lois, how'd you ever think of that answer? It really changed and saved our lives. She said, I don't know. It seemed quite obvious to me. He had said, not one person had stayed sober. And she said, you did. Oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through life going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. So he determined to do something about it. And he went down to this hospital where he had been wont to go several times on the edge of death and talked to the doctor. He said, "Doc, I don't know what the hell happened to me. You know, I was here. I thought I had some sort of spiritual experience, but apparently I don't know what there was, but I can't help anybody." The doctor says, "Well, what do you try to tell him, Bill?" He said, "Well, I try to teach him to have a spiritual experience." He says, "That's ridiculous. You can't teach him to have a religious experience." He says, "I don't know why you people come here for answers anyway. We have no answer. If we had, you guys come in here drunk, we get you sober, we give you some advice. That's no good. It's almost as though you alcoholics have an invisible shield over you, and then you just watch the advice bounce off. Boom, boom, boom. Thanks for the advice. Boom." We all know that feeling. He said, "Now, I'm not an alcoholic," the doctor said, "and I'm not a drunkard, so I don't really know. But it always seemed to me, somehow you got to get through that wall, that invisible wall." He said, "And I don't know how to get through there, but you might tell him, why don't you try telling him that you're a drunk yourself and that you had a lot of problems?" And Bill said, "That's the worst idea I ever heard, thanks. What good is that going to do me to tell him I'm a drunk?" But he went back to his home and not satisfied. And he found a letter from some people on Wall Street who said, "We understand you've been sober 6 months, Bill. That's really remarkable. You used to be very good at hustling. We got a deal out in Akron, Ohio, where we have to go out there and get some signatures, and we're going to take over this company, and we'll make you president. But if you blow this deal, don't even come back. It's a one-time operation." So Bill, happy, told everybody about it. I got my new life, and went to Akron, Ohio, and the deal blew up in his face. He had nothing. He knows it's his fault, but he's standing in the lobby of this hotel, and can't really go back and face everybody, tell them I failed again, it's not my fault. And he wrote later, he was standing in the lobby of the hotel in downtown Akron. I stood where he was some years ago, just for the hell of it. I tried standing there to see if I'd get anything, but I did, just got sore feet. But he reached in his pocket, he had a $10 bill. God. And over here was a door with a curved thing over it said "cocktails" in neon, orange neon letters. And he thought to himself, "That $10, I can either pay my hotel bill or buy a train ticket home, go back and admit I'm a failure again." And he had a feeling that I'm sure most of us would here have, that if I just had a couple drinks, I bet I could think of an answer. He started to walk over there to the bar, and all of our lifespans suddenly diminished. And he noticed across the room a bunch of payphones on the wall. Now this young lady here might not know what a payphone is. You don't go like this. It's a big old clumpy thing you throw a nickel in. And he promised his friends in New York he'd call somebody before he got drunk. So he called a bunch of ministers and nobody had any help from him. One minister finally did. He said, "Father, you're funny you should call me. I have a parishioner who just told me this week that there's a doctor in her group that's a terrible alcoholic and he admits it and he can't do anything about it. Maybe I can put you in touch with her." So he said, "Wait in that phone booth." And the doctor called, or the minister called, the woman whose home he talked to, and she said, "Well, yes, I'd like to have Bill talk to him. I'll get hold of his wife." She called his wife, and the wife said, "Yes, I'd love to have my husband talk to this man, but he's so drunk, he's under the coffee table now. We can do it tomorrow." So this woman in West Akron, a very wealthy woman, she said, "Okay, bring him out tomorrow. I'll get this man from New York out here." And they brought him together in that house.
the next day turned out to be Mother's Day of 1935. And they had a bite to eat, and they went to swim together, and the doctor had said to his wife on the way out there, "I know that it's Mother's Day, and I know that I've ruined your Mother's Day for you, Anne. I'm very, very sorry. And I'll give this guy 10 minutes. I can't stand to hear any more lectures about my drinking. I'm just so damn sick about lectures about my drinking. They don't help. All they do is make me feel worse." So they went in the side room, and they were there 4 hours. They came out, and the doctor said to his wife, "My God, Anne, that's the first man I ever talked to who seems to understand why I drink and what it does for me. Why I can't quit." He said, "Bill, I thought I was the only one in the world like this. Could you stay over a short time and spend with us? Maybe we can talk some more." Bill said, "Okay." Didn't want to go home. So they sat for a couple of weeks and just every day have coffee and talk about the spiritual values of the Oxford group and how you can enhance your religious training. Then at that time, Dr. Bob, the doctor said to Bill, he said, "Bill, this weekend in Akron, Ohio, or in Atlantic City, New Jersey, is the National Convention of the American Medical Association. I was there last year and I was so drunk, they all ridiculed me and laughed at me. I want to go this year and show them what we found here. Wait here and I'll be home. You stay with my wife and kids over the weekend. I'll be home Tuesday morning." So away he went, and I went, "Oh, good. It's going to be just wonderful." Tuesday morning came, phone rang, a woman on the phone said, "Mrs. Smith, I'm sorry, this is the doctor's office nurse. They carried him off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And I'm so sorry, he was trying so hard. I know he tried an experiment to stop drinking, couldn't. But the station agent knew that I worked for him, and he called me, and I came down here, and the cab driver and I have taken him up to the office. He's laying on the floor of the office crying. And I don't know what to do." And Mrs. Smith said, "Well, I'll tell you what. You wait there. Mr. Wilson and I will be down to pick him up and bring him home." So they went down and got this drunken slob and brought him home. I've been working with alcoholics for a lot of years, and one of the more sickening sights of the world is a crying drunk. God, they're sickening. "I'm so sorry. Now you're sorry, you son of a bitch." And so they brought him home and put him to Bill, put him to bed. A couple of days later, Thursday morning, he said, "What day is it?" "Thursday morning, Bob." He said, "Oh my God, I've got to do a cancer surgery today. I can't hold a knife, look at my hand. What am I going to do? They'll take my license. I put this thing off twice already." So his new friend Bill went out and got him some beer to settle his hand. "Oh, that's better. I can go to the hospital now and do the surgery. I'll be home about 2 o'clock. Away he went. 2 o'clock came, he didn't come home. 3 o'clock, didn't come home. 4 o'clock, didn't come home. 5 o'clock, son of a bitch must be drunk again. 6 o'clock, the door opened, there's cold sober, the doctor says, 'Where you been, Bob?' He said, 'Well, when I was doing that surgery this morning, it suddenly struck me, the Oxford group that I belong to always thinks that you should make amends when you made errors. But I never thought that applied to a doctor. But I realized I'm a human being first before I'm a doctor. So I've been all over Akron today making amends to people, and I feel wonderful.'" And they didn't know, but that day they celebrated the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't know they instead of starting Alcoholics, all they knew was that the two drunken bums trying to hang on. But the reason that's important to remember, because today is the 81st anniversary of that day, June 10th, 1935. This is our birthday. And if you want to give any gifts to A, I'll see that they're taken care of. But A has since little by little expanded and expanded. Now it's in 154 countries around the world. Mary and I have been to several places the last few years. I spoke in Bangkok and Rio de Janeiro and all over Europe and Spain last year, a lot of places. And you think it'd be really different, but walking in here tonight is the same thing exactly. Same old steps. Sometimes they're in a different language. Mm-hmm. Same old traditions. Same old guy sitting up in front trying to, how do I get these fools to be quiet, you know? And the people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I had a terrible time with AA. I was in and out for 10 years before I stayed sober. I developed really a strong belief, I'm not really an alcoholic and I can prove it. I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow night, I guess. But I somehow stayed sober. And now in a few months, it'll be 58 years since I've had a drink or a pill. I've lived in reality. In fact, I have a license plate a guy gave me a couple years ago. It said, AA 58. Because that's the year I got sober. Now, if I could just hold on to October, that'll be my sobriety date. I'm also 58. I don't know if I can hang on that long. But anyway, to those who are new, I know that this seems very strange and odd. I hope you go to a lot of meetings. And I hope you'll find someone that you think you can trust when you're in these meetings and ask him to be your sponsor. And then do what he says. That saved my life. I finally got a sponsor who I couldn't outwit. And he saved my life. And he'll save yours. Today, I know how many meetings have I sat in? Those dumb steps. Christ, I could do those by noon tomorrow. What do I need all this crap for? And it turns out you can't do by noon, not doing right. But A works. And it works well. But knowing it doesn't help. You have to do it. You have to have someone help you, show you how to do it. You can be as slick as you think you can want to be. I don't need that shit, baby. Well, the next time you sober up, think about it. That's how it works for all of us. And everyone in this room, I'm sure, came to this organization thinking, but my case is different. They don't really understand. They mean well, but they're dummies. And pretty soon you'll be one of those who don't understand. You'll be a dummy. And you help someone behind you, and they'll make you feel very good. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Thank you.
Very good.
Michael.
Someone follow that, Michael?
Yeah, that's a
little name. We're going to stay
until. Oh, yeah, thank you. My name's Michael, I'm an alcoholic.
It's
really good to be here tonight. I've had to promise myself, no matter how tired I am, and no matter what's going on, I've got to get to meetings. So I'm here tonight. I wouldn't normally come tonight because I had all the excuses. I'm tired, I'm busy, the family needs me, I've got to work again tomorrow. So really I should rest. I went bugger it and rang Greg and here we are. So it's good. And it was a bit of a surprise to see Clancy as well. I've seen Clancy before, probably, I don't know how many years ago, probably 18 years ago or 19 years ago or something, at Mount Gravatt, I think it was, or somewhere down South Brisbane. Yeah, somewhere there. And it was nice to hear Clancy talk. What are the topics tonight or whatever? Whatever, okay, yeah. I'm an alcoholic, that's why I'm here. My drinking period of my life was rather short. I started drinking really full on when I was about 15, and I was all done and dusted by the age of 20. So I only had about 5 years of drinking, and you know, that's the miracle of AA. The only reason I got to AA so early in life was because I left home when I was 15 and I left my parents really concerned about me. My dad read the big book. I didn't know this, of course, but Dad read the big book and Mum went to Al-Anon and took my brothers and sisters to Alateen. So they were all praying for me and all that. And it used to be, I'd see them occasionally, and I remember one time I saw them, and I'd just gotten out of an unregistered, unroadworthy car. I was unlicensed, and I was drunk and going to get some more dope to go back to the party, and they'd just come from church, you know. And they just looked like aliens, you know, like I was in some other world. And, yeah. And I used to ring Mum up occasionally and say, I owe money, you got to give me money or they're going to get me, because I knew that it sort of, you know, she'd give me some. And she started going to Al-Anon, so she learned how to say no. And I was, you know, and one time things were bad. I think basically what happened was I went to move in with these people because I developed a theory that, you know, I never thought I was an alcoholic, but I developed a theory that I had a social phobia. I was scared of talking to people, which was true. You know, if you smoke enough dope, you're going to be scared of talking to people and drink, and you know, it happens. Well, it happened to me. And so I went and joined this Rosie's Youth Mission, which was this good mission down the Gold Coast in Advancetown. And they lived in community. I didn't care what their mission was. They lived in community. You know, so I thought I'd overcome my social phobia by living in community. You know. And they used to go into the streets of Surfers Paradise and talk to all the street junk and get a bit of Jesus into them at the same time, basically, you know. And so I joined them and I just didn't fit in, and there was all these people in my face all the time, and it was stressing me out, and they were Catholic, and there was plenty of wine, and I found it and I drank it and I ended up getting kicked out, and I basically ended up on the streets in Surfers Paradise. And and I kind of liked that. I did that for while the money was still there. It was a bit of excitement, you know, hanging around with street drunks and seeing what they get up to. And they liked me because I wasn't banned from all the bottle-o's, so I used to get booze for us. Anyway, things got bad. And I remember ringing my mother, and I remember saying to her, oh, I need somewhere to live. And she said to me, well, you can come and stay with me, but you have to go to AA. And I'm pretty sure I said, hey, what? Like, I had no idea what AA was or what it was about, and I wasn't looking, you know what I mean? And but that was the deal. So basically, that's how I got to my first meeting. I went and I went to stay with Mum. Some bloke picked me up. I remember he came. I remember his name and his father. Anyway, he came and he picked me up, and he just talked non-stop. Like, he just didn't shut up, just blah, 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 the whole way to the meeting. And he said, we got to the meeting and he said, oh, look, you got to take the cotton wool out of your, ears, stick it in your mouth, shut up and listen, this will save your life. And I thought, you're an idiot, I haven't said a word. And then, and then he told me to sit up the front. And I thought, well, as long as you're sitting up the back, I'll sit up the front. And I remember sitting up the front, and it was a birthday meeting, the Damascus Holy Spirit Hospital meeting. And I think it felt like, you know, 300 people were sitting behind me, and I was just trapped, and I couldn't go anywhere. And I thought, this is crap. And I didn't listen to a word until somebody talked about being a boxer. And talked about, you know, that, and I thought, oh, boxers are cool, I'll listen to this guy. And he was talking about the pre-fight and, you know, how he always thought it was the fifth drink where he lost control. And he talked about controlling his drinking with matches, you know, and I'm listening to him, yeah, that makes sense. And he's got these five matches in his left pocket, and he thought he'll keep an eye on his drinking. For every drink, he'll take a match from his left and put it in his right. And once he got three matches in his right, he borrowed two back and put it in his left. And I just thought, yeah, you know, and he talked about, you know, once he started drinking, you know, he just couldn't stop. And I just started listening, and I identified with people that talked about that, you know. Like, I remember the way I selected alcohol was not on the taste, was not on the flavour or whatever. It was just that little number on the bottle, you know, and the bigger that little number was, you know, 38, 40, 50, yeah, I was in, you know, and that's how I drank. And apparently, that's not normal, you know, to start drinking and lose control and not be able to stop and all that. In any case, I didn't stay sober from that first meeting, because I remember I left there. Before I left, I instantly hated the bloke that took me there, but that wasn't unusual. I hated everyone. And I remember him saying to me, if you don't pick up one drink one day at a time, you can't get drunk. And I thought, how easy is that shit? I'll just do that, you know. It wasn't the message, but it was all he had for me. Mm-hmm. And so I left. I said to Mum and Dad, oh, this shit's easy. I won't pick up one drink one day at a time. And then I went out and scored a bag of dope, and I wasn't drinking one day at a time, and I thought I was sober, you know. And, yeah. And that went really badly over, I don't know how long. I think it was a few months. And basically, things got really bad. And I finally came back to AA for all the right reasons. And I came to AA because I was too scared of what would happen if I was going to drink again. That's basically it. I don't need to go into what happened, but it was bad enough for me. And, you know, it was in August of 93. And then in September of 93, I had my last drink because I still thought marijuana was okay for a little while. And I had a good sponsor, and he would say to me, you're not sober, you're just smoking dope, you know. And I need to be told that. Like, I thought, no, it's okay, it's got to be okay, it's natural, it grows in the garden. What's wrong with it? And anyway, that was a long time ago, and I've been sober ever since. I only drank for, I don't know, 6 years, and I've been sober for 23 years. And I remember thinking at the 7-year mark something will happen, you know, once I double it. Anyway, it doesn't. It's just, you know, it's just one day at a time. And lately, my struggle is getting here, because a lot of the time I'm not consumed with self as much, because I get really involved in my work and I put my thought life into my work. But I've found that to be really dangerous, because it just slowly leads back to me whinging about my work instead of enjoying my work, and feeling self-centered and losing that prayer life that I need. But, you know, I've got to have that balance. I've still got to maintain it. And Clancy's here 58 years later. I hope I'm the same if I live that long. yeah. So, you know, and I've identified that, and I can't not do without having a sponsor still today, having friends that I can ring up, and just get honest, you know. Like, sometimes it feels a bit embarrassing because I should know better, and it makes it worse when you've got a friend like Greg, because he points out how embarrassing it is. He gives me shit about it, you know. And you ring your sponsor and he goes, yeah, you're nuts, go to meeting, you know, and real helpful stuff. You know, but it, you know, and that's the way I've got to be. It's the same as when I started. I've got to be honest about myself. You know, it doesn't matter about you guys. You guys got to be honest about yourself. I've got to be honest about me. You know, and I've got to give my day to God every day. That's, you know, highly important for me, especially in my job, because I have to make decisions all day, every day that affect others. And they got to be the right decision, you know. And I can't do that without inspiration, because if I don't give my mind, you know, please God direct my thinking, if I don't do that, then it's just all about me, you know. And that ain't good for people. It isn't even good for me. That's what I've learned. And I'm a grateful member. Thank you.
I'm
going to
go one more. Chris, you want to wind it up?
Hey, my name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
Didn't think we had time. Gratefully sober today, and love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and 81 years, you know, Founders Day, it means a lot. I got very interested in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, funnily enough, here in Clancy 20-odd years ago in Melbourne, you know, and I'm interested in the fellowship that saved my life, and I was sitting there having a chuckle tonight. You know, you come into your first meeting and it doesn't sound too promising, does it? You know, they get you to stand up and identify as being the new people here. I wanted to hide under the seat when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to be, you know, I got here at the age of 26 back in 1990, and I wasn't going to stay. And the proof's in the pudding that I'm still here after all these years, you know. And I felt like people spoke about tonight. You know, I felt like that I was different and I didn't really fit in, and the one thing that won me about Alcoholics Anonymous was strange. It wasn't what anyone really said. It was at the second meeting that I went to. I went to this meeting and I sat in the chair and a guy tapped me on the shoulder And he smiled at me and shook my hand because he was at the first meeting that I went to. Mm-hmm. And there was something about that smile and something about the way he shook his hand and said, glad to see you. Because people weren't saying I was glad to see me. People were saying glad to see the arse end of me. And that was the one thing I hung on to that for a long time. I guess John spoke a little bit about, you know, I hung around long enough for the magic to start happening. But, you know, I heard Clancy talk about, you know, all those years ago about that, you know, if drinking was the problem, you just got to stop drinking and everything would be okay. And it wasn't okay, you know. I was 3 years off the drinking, totally mad. And because I didn't do the suggested things, you know, and pain's a great motivator, and I finally succumbed and got a sponsor and got a home group and started to work through the solution to what Alcoholics Anonymous was, and my life took off, and it still takes off today, you know, and the proof's in the pudding. We get to see it, you know, 58 years sober, 23 years sober, 20 years, this guy's going to be 25 years sober on Wednesday, you know. They inspire me because they're still, you know, I hope I'm still doing what Clancy's doing. He's nearly 90, he was telling us there before, and that's just inspirational, you know, and you know, I hope I keep being inspired by the people that are going before me, you know. And you know, I laugh. I my sponsor lives in Las Vegas, and he asked me to be guest speaker at his home group meeting, and I was one of the 10-minute speakers. Gary Crankston was another 10-minute speaker, and Clancy's the guest speaker. And I'm up there speaking, and he's sitting in the front row going, I was stealing his time. So on that note, you know, I'm so grateful, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams, and you know, and it seems funky stuff to start off with, you know, like we do hold hands and pray and we do some funny things here, but if you hang around long enough, you know, the miracle will happen as long as you stay. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
All right, that does bring us to the close of the meeting. Are there any announcements? Let's make one for tomorrow night at least. That we have Founders Night at the Coolum Community Centre. The address?
Park Street, Coolum, next to the Jack Morgan Park.
There we go. And that's for a what time start?
It starts at
7 p.m.
Okay. Sorry.
Thank you, Ollie. Was there any other announcements that we wanted to cover tonight?
Well, I wanted to do a GSA report, but I might hold it over till next week. But I do want people to think about this, that we need, and when election time comes up, we definitely need some positions filled, and one of them is GSA. And if somebody wants to put their hand up to come walk with me and learn how to be a GSA, then that's a really important thing to do. We do need that position filled. And if there's anything else that you want to know, just
kind of
just
put on standing
toes. There's a lot of notices up there, things to have a look at, things to read, come
sell. Thank you. This group endorses sponsorship. If anybody's interested in finding a sponsor or a temporary sponsorship, please see our secretary, as we have a list of members happy to be of service in this important area of recovery. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our fellowship, so just a friendly reminder, please don't gossip, please don't criticise. What you see here, what you hear here, please leave it here. Tonight I am going to ask Stuart if he will just read Tradition 9 from the banner, if you will. Thank you. And we will close tonight's meeting with Christine, who will be reading from a chapter, A Vision for You, from the basic textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, followed by joining hands and sharing in the Serenity Prayer.
I'm Christine, alcoholic.
Chris.
On page 164, that's the bit you've got to get to. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realise we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to us and to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you.
Guys, to a God of your understanding. God,
grant.